You've probably heard the news from the college sports world. Harvard University's men's soccer team's season abruptly canceled after news that since 2012, the team produced scouting reports and spreadsheets that rated members of the women's soccer team based on their sexual appeal. The Harvard Crimson first reported this last month, and since then, it's been reported that the Harvard men's cross-country team also has a similar spreadsheet. How widespread is this, and why is it happening? Let's ask Michael Kimmel, professor of sociology at Stony Brook University in New York and executive director of the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities. One of them is hypermasculinity. Professor Michael, welcome.
Nice to be with you, Robin.
And first, we should say Harvard is still investigating the spreadsheet put together by members of the men's cross-country team. So we'll await to see what happens there. But what was your reaction when you heard about the soccer team's season canceled and this spreadsheet revealed?
Well, my initial response when I heard of the spreadsheet and the ratings and all of that is basically, you know, a big sigh of disappointment that the athletes don't see their female teammates, as colleagues, but rather they see them, they have a kind of adversarial view of the relations between women and men, which I had thought was largely being surpassed on most college campuses. On the other hand, when Harvard's president, Drew Faust, actually acted so decisively to cancel the rest of the season, even though Harvard was leading in the Ivy League, even though they were going to go to the NCAA tournament, I thought, well, good for her, good for standing up for what's right, even in the face of, you know, the fact that it happens elsewhere, other people do it. You know, it sends a very strong message. Because, you know, when Harvard speaks, America's universities listen.
Well, that announcement sent the girls team, the girls soccer team, out a few days later to win the Ivies. I mean, they actually won. But before that, they expressed such sadness because, as you said, these are teammates, in effect. These men's and women's teams share facilities, share workout practice times, often share road trips. Yeah. Many of these young women have expressed that they actually thought of these men as, you know, siblings, as brothers.
Yeah, this is, I think, the heartbreaking revelation. And I think the letter that was written to the Crimson by the women who were first-year students in 2012, who were the ones who were rated, who graduated in 2016, you know, it's heartbreaking to realize that while you're working with someone as what you think of as an equal, they're really secretly treating you quite unequally behind closed doors. And I think that this is no different than the revelation that happens, for example, when women in the workplace find out that the guys are ranking the, you know, rating them, you know, in the same sort of way. You know, you think, but I thought you thought we were your colleagues. Right. I thought you treated us equally. How could you be doing this to us? And it's heartbreaking.
Well, quoting again from some of the response, Ruth Conniff, who's a former college runner, editor-in-chief of The Progressive, wrote about this before this event, and she said, one of the best things about the rise of women's sports is the friendship and camaraderie it engenders between boys and girls. Megan Cake Nelson was a former cross-country team member back in the early 90s, and she wrote in The Crimson about that sense of camaraderie and how they trained together, traveled together, how the girls cheered the men on as they ran their races. And then one day in 1993, some of the members of the men's cross-country team came to a practice wearing T-shirts that featured a list of the female runners' names, actually their initials, ranked by how many wanted a sexual act from the male athletes. You know, stunning. I mean, it's right there on their chests, you know, the men's chests for them to see. And here, a couple decades later, it gets even worse. Well, but how widespread do you think this is? Do you think this is part of the privilege of the elite campus of Harvard?
No, I think this is probably pretty widespread. I think also that it is probably on the decline in its sort of casual, unapologetic nature. So I don't think the guys would be coming to practice wearing T-shirts that said such things now, but they might do it, you know, in their own group chat.
Yeah, they might do it on a spreadsheet.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I do think it is part of, you know, what can you say, locker room talk, so to speak. On the other hand, I do think it's likely to be declining only because of the dramatic increase in girls and young women who are playing sports. This old notion that, you know, the girls were the cheerleaders and the boys played the sports has been completely eradicated by the dramatic success of Title IX in high schools and middle schools. where close to half of all girls are playing sports, whereas probably 40 years ago it was maybe 10%. So that's been one of the biggest changes in high schools as well as colleges. And I think that gradually women and men are seeing themselves as increasingly equal.
Well, but you have cases like two Texas A&M football coaches earlier this year suspended after organizing a women's football clinic that had a sexist version of the school's fight song and these faux instructions that were all, you know, filled with sexual innuendo. You had in 2013 Tufts University suspending 27 male lacrosse players for shouting sexist comments at women playing a volleyball game. Mm-hmm. So you have these incidents. And you mentioned the locker room talk. You have, on a national scale, you have the president-elect on tape talking with an entertainer, Billy Bush, about grabbing women's genitals.
Right.
You say it's declined, but is that an okay for it to, you know, what are you seeing culturally?
Well, you know, just because I think that in general it's on the decline does not mean we're going to continue to hear about all of these egregious examples that you're citing. But what you don't hear about are the coaches who say, you know what, on my watch, this will not happen. If any of you do any of this, you're off the team. Goodbye. Done. So I think, yes, of course, we have these egregious examples. And yes, of course, we have this this notion stated on a videotape that it's perfectly okay that locker room talk can even include confessions of actual sexual assault. So, yes, of course, we have this. And yes, of course, this is going to give people a sense of that permission. But here's what's missing. Okay. In that tape, we had something happening. We had Trump bragging to these guys about what he was able to do because of his celebrity. And their response to him was, oh, my God, you are just so awesome. I wish I could be you. I wish I could do that, too. Now, here's the part that's important. When some male players on some male team start to do this sort of thing, here's what's necessary. Some male players on that same team say, not okay.
Well, how do you get that to happen, Professor?
Well, again, I truly believe that is happening. And that, in fact, those are the stories we never hear reported because nothing terrible happens. These kinds of things happen only because of other guys' silence, that other guys who feel uncomfortable with it kind of grudgingly go along because it's the guy thing to do. It's locker room talk. It'll never get out. You'll never get in trouble for it. And I think these guys are increasingly feeling that, you know, they're also feeling emboldened. They're also feeling, with all of the work in sexual assault on campuses, all of the bystander intervention projects that have been developed on every single campus in the country, that what you're seeing is that these guys are also feeling braver now to say, not okay with me. And that, I think, is going to be the thing that ends it ultimately.
Well, and Michael Kimmel, again, you are a professor of sociology. You're the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities. So I want to ask you a question more broadly. You don't know the Harvard students at all, but why would a Harvard star soccer player even need to denigrate women? What is that missing there? That, I mean, you're at the peak of your college sport, presumably a big man on campus. Why would they even need to do this?
Well, because there's two reasons why. One, because they can. Because they feel entitled. There's also, you know, while on the one hand, these are some of the most talented, brilliant students that, you know, this country could possibly produce, and they feel quite entitled to do whatever they want. And secondly, because men often have experienced women's equality as somehow a zero-sum game. And that now that women's sports are getting equal funding and are, you know, recruiting just the same way, some of these guys still maintain a kind of adversarial idea of how women and men should behave. And the key word that you used before was siblings. That the more equal that students get on campuses, the more they see each other as brothers and sisters, and they do stand up for each other when they see each other that way. That's not adversarial. That is familial.
Michael Kimmel, professor of sociology at Stony Brook University in New York, executive director of the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities. Professor, thank you.
Sure. Nice to be with you, Robin.